Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to The Book Pod with Corey Perkin, the fortnightly podcast that brings readers and writers together. Today we acknowledge the traditional owners of the Boona Wurrung Nation where this podcast is produced and pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging.
Hello to all our podcast friends and welcome to today's episode of The Book Pod. A few weeks ago I had the pleasure of hosting a webinar with Hannah Kent, the award-winning South Australian writer whose debut novel, Burial Rites, arrived like a meteor in 2013, and whose recent novel, Devotion, confirms her place as one of Australia's major literary talents. Devotion is a beautiful story of friendship, love, and the ties that bind us. It is the winner of Booktopia's Favourite Australian Book Award for 2021, and has just been shortlisted for the Indie Book Awards for Fiction, the winner of which will be announced in June. Devotion begins in a 19th century Prussian village where a group of Lutheran worshippers are being persecuted by the Emperor Franz Joseph. A long sea voyage to Australia forms the meaty middle part of this book before our exiled migrant settler characters arrive in South Australia and establish their small community in what is now the Adelaide Hills region. As The Guardian wrote in its review last year, Devotion, quote, is a love story ardent and wholesome, and it drapes its readers in lush historical detail. Fans will find a lot to savour. And so have we. The book clubs we run read Devotion over the summer break, and the discussions that followed were spirited and intense. This book certainly packs a punch and throws forward many interesting issues for book clubs and readers generally to consider. I hope you enjoy my discussion with Hannah Kent. I loved meeting her again, and I hope you enjoy Devotion.
Hannah, it's great to see you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's so exciting to join you here.
Oh, it's wonderful. Hannah, we're here, of course, for Devotion, but to ask you lots of other questions about what's been happening in the last couple of years since we last saw you. This, of course, is my much beloved treasured reading copy that arrived in the mail probably about August last year, and I just couldn't wait to rip into it. It probably a bit more well-worn because I've read it now about three times. Hannah, it arrived in our stores late October last year. There was great excitement, particularly among Melbourne bookshops, which were just emerging from yet another extended two-month lockdown. So everybody was very excited that they had a book of yours to sell. And readers were excited. Since your remarkable debut novel, Burial Rites, in 2013, and then the success of The Good People a couple of years later, you've built up such a huge and loyal fan club. Congratulations on the achievements of Devotion so far. It is in the top five of the Australian bestsellers list. It has been pretty much since its release, actually. It has harnessed extensive praise from the critics and readers alike. It's been shortlisted for the Indie Novel of the Year. It was Booktopia's Book of the Year in 2021, and indeed our own Book of the Year here. And a beautiful hardcover edition this month arrived in the UK bookstores. So all your fans in Britain are now reading their way through the story of Hannah and Thea.
Thank you so much. That's so lovely. And I didn't know that about sales. So thank you for sharing that. I like to sort of be kept in the dark because it just is like another world to me. But that's really lovely to hear that people are enjoying it.
They're loving it. And I can honestly say firsthand evidence that there are book clubs around Australia who have been ploughing through and are still reading and intend to read your book over the next few months. Before we discuss devotion, Hannah, I just wanted to ask how the past couple of years have been for you. Last time we met, it was 2016 at the bookshop. You were not married. There were no children. And you and your partner, Heidi, were living in Melbourne. Now you and your wife are the parents of two small children. You've moved back to South Australia. And you have the new novel. So tell me what's been happening.
You summarized it really well. So it's been 5 years, no, 7 years now since the Good People came out. 5 years since between books. And 2017 was a big year. That was the year I started working on devotion. And then very fortunately, we decided to have children. I became pregnant, but that was also the year of the same-sex plebiscite. And we decided to get married actually on the day that Australia said yes. And then the following year we were married. By that stage we'd had a little girl. 2019 we were married, had a little girl in between, and now we have a little boy as well. And basically in between these big life events, which very fortunately we managed to sort of make happen. My son was born just actually as we went into our first lockdown. He's a real COVID baby. I was writing devotion, and I was also writing a film script, which is currently being shot in Victoria and soon to be in SA, a new psychological horror film called Run Rabbit Run. So really it's, I feel in many ways that there's been lots of things happening, but also that I really just haven't left my house in a very, very long time. Work and babies, it's basically hit the nail on the head.
So moving back to your home area in South Australia in the Adelaide Hills, was that an easy decision to make to leave Melbourne, or a difficult one? And how's it been during the actual sort of lockdown, the two-year period?
It was a pretty easy decision. I think I never necessarily intended to remain in Melbourne. I love Melbourne and, gosh, I miss it, especially now. Can't wait to return for a visit. But, you know, my family, including my sister, who I'm very close to, they all still live in South Australia. And it was, we didn't necessarily intend to move back to the Adelaide Hills, which is very specifically the place where I grew up. But in just one of those, you know, moments of serendipity or synchronicity, we found a lovely place to live up here. But it's great, actually. I'm enjoying the slower lifestyle. Got a wonderful veggie garden going, and things are quite quiet, which ended up being sort of what we wanted as as COVID took over and everything got shut down. And like I said, really the various lockdowns and the spread of the pandemic, I mean, we were in a bubble anyway. I think they made the announcement that hospitals weren't allowing guests the day before I had my son. So you know, we were stuck at home doing not very much anyway. But yeah, we've started to really feel it, especially being separated from loved ones and friends in Melbourne. Yeah.
Hannah, this novel is, none of us should be surprised, because you are an extraordinary storyteller with a vast imagination, but such creativity, so many ideas in all of your three novels. The first two, of course, were based on factual events, but even so, there's just a surprise almost at every turn of a page, and it's one of the many things I love about your novels. What prompted the idea of devotion? We've all read, I think, a few interviews that you've done. You've talked about how novels about gay relationships these days are now not uncommon, but when you were growing up, and you know me several years before you, there was just nothing available. And I read somewhere that you originally thought this idea might be a story of a friendship between two girls, and I wondered what triggered the idea of the romance.
It's a good question. Yeah, I was. It's interesting because I think this book has been a reaction to My Others, in the way that The Good People was never a reaction to Burial Rites. When I started thinking about what I wanted to write next, I knew that I didn't want to do the same thing again, which was really finding a true crime event from history and researching it within, you know, the nth degree, and then sort of trying to subvert that narrative whilst also remaining true to it. I didn't want to write about another murdering woman because I felt that I would be painting myself into a corner as a novelist. And I wanted to try something different. And for me, so much of the joy of writing comes down to practice. It's always about the writing itself. That's why I do it. I mean, it's wonderful to have books published. It's amazing to have readers, and I'm so grateful for it. But I think to write a book, it always has to come back down to the, you know, the joy of the act itself. And one of the reasons I love writing is because I find it difficult. And I really wanted to challenge myself with my third novel. And so I thought, well, I don't want to write about a criminal woman from history. I was also ready to move into lighter territory, not necessarily in the sense that it was, you know, bubbly or frivolous, but I wanted to move away from very, you know, grim landscapes, grim events. I was ready to celebrate something, I think. And initially, when I was sort of thinking about where I wanted to set the novel and what sort of things I wanted to explore, I was really considering friendship. And initially, I thought, I'm going to write a book about two women whose friendship is the most sustaining, meaningful relationship in their lives. And sort of around the same time that I was deciding that, I had started thinking and reading a lot about the immigration of Prussian Germans or Prussian Lutherans to South Australia shortly after the passing of the South Australian Act. It was something that growing up in the Adelaide Hills on Paramount Country, near villages like Harndorf, which is still a massive tourist destination, and the Barossa, I was always really aware of sort of the inherited, of the cultural legacy of these German immigrants. But when I moved to Melbourne and I tried using words like Metwurst and Fritz and Delikatessen, you know, I didn't know what a milk bar was. I started realizing that not many people were familiar with this part of our colonial history. And I was, I was thinking about maybe I was ready to write about the Australian landscape, which is something that is very dear to me. And perhaps for that reason, it was too close. I didn't want to write about it yet. And then all of these sort of interests were, I mean, I don't have a very strong plan when I sit down to write. I sort of move towards the things that are compelling me or just kind of occupy my mind. And then, as I said earlier, it was 2017 and we had the plebiscite on same-sex marriage. And I mean, and that was such a difficult year, even though it ended, you know, in changes to legislation, it was still really difficult. Really, there was a lot of strain and pressure on the queer community in South Australia.
We forget that, don't we? We forget there was so much anger and anguish and sadness and fear and hope. It was just from all aspects, for all parts of the community, I think were involved in this issue.
Yeah, well, it was just kind of an extraordinarily unnecessary thing to happen, I think. I won't go into the, you know, too much of the political stuff surrounding it because we know what's happened since, and I don't think it bears to dwell in that space. But I mean, we were receiving, here we are, we just bought our first house, we were incredibly excited about the prospect of starting a life. I was pregnant, and we're getting pamphlets in the mail saying that, you know, me and my would-be wife are all sorts of awful things. And as much as you, I think, as a natural process of growing up as a queer person, come to accept yourself and you build resilience and tolerance, I mean, it still has an effect. It's still difficult because you're fighting against it. And I think it was that, and it was my own frustration and my own anger that made me think, I don't want to write about friendship. Why should I write about friendship? There's a lot that has been said about it. What don't we have as a community? And there's still very few narratives of positive representation of queer love. I mean, there are many more now, especially contemporary novels, but as a historical novelist, I mean, what are there? What novels exist within a historical context? We have very sort of despondent titles like The Well of Loneliness, or where things start to get better with The Price of Salt, the Patricia Highsmith, or Carol, as it's also been published as. Sarah Waters has some fantastic sort of queer romps, but I really wanted to see then if I could change that meaningful friendship into a meaningful relationship whilst retaining what I had then decided to be the landscape and the backdrop of this very pious old Lutheran German communities emigrating. And therein I thought, well, that seems like an impossible task. And once I realised how challenging it would be, I couldn't not do it. So that was really the point where devotion became devotion. Before that, it was just me amassing these disparate ideas. And it wasn't until I really tapped into my own frustration at that lack of narrative and my desire and my realisation too that I was in a position to contribute a story and to contribute towards representation, that I made my mind up.
Hannah, I do want to ask you a bit more about the writing about the Australian bush and how you found that writing about the landscape in a moment. But I want to get back to the sort of the very beginning. And we know that we know from burial rites and the good people that research and sort of delving into a time that we are unfamiliar with here in Australia has been very important to you, and it intrigues you. And this for the rest of Australia who may not be familiar with South Australia's very rich and important German and Prussian connection, can you just tell us a little bit about how you actually researched the story of Hannah Nussbaum, the teenage girl living in 19th century Prussia in this small Lutheran community that increasingly is being persecuted by an emperor who wants not all of these different strands of Protestantism, but like so many emperors and kings, wants to kind of control the masses by controlling religion. How you kind of researched that and what was involved?
So even though with this book I ended up moving away from that sort of methodology, or that, I guess, the ethical framework I had set for myself in terms of representing the past on the page with my other two books, it was still, research was still crucial to this book in so many ways. One, because I think even if you're creating characters and they're not based on the dead, I think there is still, you know, a responsibility to portraying the past. And I think writers, I mean, I shouldn't really speak for others, I feel a responsibility towards portraying certain aspects of the way in which people used to live, what they believed, their cultural practices, with reverence that I think you can demonstrate through research. The other reason is that I also feel that research contributes so much to, I guess, the creative inspiration behind a novel. I tend not to sort of map out the plot of a book and then go and research to fill in the gaps. I like just to read as widely as possible from a variety of different texts and sources. And then I'll come across these amazing little stories, or I'll get ideas for characters, and I keep a notebook and I tend to write it all down there. And then my research becomes a little bit more finely focused as characters come to life. And eventually I get to the point where I feel that I know enough and I can write out of my familiarity or saturation from that time period and leave the books behind. And hopefully then only the relevant information will make its way into the book. In terms of what sources I turned to, they were just as varied as my previous two novels. But probably the more significant ones was I spent a lot of time reading about the food histories of the Barossa Valley and the viticulture there. And I chose people who wrote about these things in a very expansive way, with lots of anecdotal stories, lots of local histories brought in. I actually had, with my previous two novels, there was an absolute, it was difficult to find information. There was a dearth of information available specifically about the people I had chosen to write about. With this novel, there is so much available about these communities and these congregations who, as you said, fled Prussia in the 1830s and 40s because they were being persecuted under the rule of King Frederick William III, who had decided to unify the Protestant churches within Prussia, and increasingly over the years had started to persecute those who refused to join to the Union Church by placing them in prison, by fining them to the point of, you know, absolute poverty, to imprisoning the pastors and persecuting them. And so I read a lot of local letters, mainly from the perspective of people who did eventually emigrate and what they remembered about their time in Prussia, and then their first impressions of South Australia. I read, like I said, a lot of food histories, which touched into the wider history about it. I really liked those because they privileged a lot of domestic information, which sometimes can be completely absent in other sources because it's often women-centered, or people think that it's not significant enough to contribute to sort of a dominant narrative. I also found the most incredible journals written by a captain who ended up bringing about 200 Prussian immigrants over to South Australia. And the extraordinary thing about these journals is I started reading them because I thought, well, you know, I've never been on a three-masted ship. I don't know what it would be like to spend 6 months on such a place. What did they eat? What did they do? And I started reading these very dry, maritimey journals just to get, you know, little mentions of the weather or rations. And then right at the end of the journals, this captain sort of stopped and said, everything that I've shared about the immigrants, I actually haven't been entirely truthful. And then he includes essentially a catalogue of conflicts and problems and characterizations of these immigrants, because some of these conflicts which had arisen due to conditions on the boat were ongoing, and he thought he would have to testify in court. And that was the resource that when I read it, suddenly these communities that I'd been reading about in these very vague sort of hagiographic terms came alive, and I saw individual faces, and there was this real sort of human experience to it, you know, this sense of not everything going so well, or people still being petty despite their, you know, avowals to God and their position as elders in the church. And that was the point where the, I guess, the broader cast of characters in this book really, I drew so heavily from that, from those journals. That was truly such a wonderful thing. But I mean, I could go on and on about the various resources I found useful. I researched for quite a long time, and the same was true.
Did you go to that part of Europe?
I didn't actually, because by the time that I was fine focusing on those elements of the story, we were in a pandemic and I wasn't able to travel. So I spent a lot of time on Google Earth.
You're going to have to make the journey.
I'd love to. I'm terrified to, because imagine if I get there and it's completely incorrect. But, you know, hopefully I've done my work.
You do give us a very strong sense of the landscape over there, as you do here as well. Tell me about Hannah and Thea as characters, but particularly Hannah, because she's our narrator. With Hannah, she's such a beautiful character of nature, I feel, and she must have been a curious child. I get the feeling that because she's so intuitive, she has heightened emotional intelligence and is very passionate in her responses, not only her love for Thea, but as a human being, that perhaps she was a bit of an oddity in that group of quite emotionally austere and quiet Lutherans. What did you want her to be? What do you think she is? And how do you see Thea as a companion, compare and contrast, or a similar spirit, or how do they both fit in?
One of the things that became apparent to me quite early on in the research process was the abundance of information available. And I realised at that stage I was hoping to find a story of two women who were close friends that perhaps then I could turn into a queer story, or I was hoping, and I knew I wouldn't find it, and of course I didn't, any kind of documentation regarding a same-sex relationship. What I realised as I was reading, you know, these myriad family histories and these letters and these diary entries, was that there was so much information and there was so much awareness in contemporary communities in South Australia about these people and about the facts in these sources, that to stay true to the known record or to use real people's names, I was absolutely going to annoy someone, and I was going to get a lot of angry emails saying, you know, my great-great-grandfather Johann never said this, and he married, you know, I was going to annoy people. And so I made the very kind of freeing decision to only use my research as kind of a suggestion and to invent my characters. And by that stage, as soon as I decided I was going to invent my characters, Hannah and Tia materialized. They were there from the start, and they didn't really change over the drafting process. I always had a very strong, the American writer Ron Rash, who is a wonderful short story writer and also a novelist, I interviewed him once, and he spoke about how every story starts with this sort of glimpse, this sort of tiny vision. And then as he thinks about it, you know, it's like the camera widens and he starts to see the whole sort of aspect of the story or what's happening. And something similar happened with me with this. I had this vision of a very, you know, blonde young woman in a field, in an agricultural setting with the sun coming down. It was Australian light, and she was being observed by someone who loved her very deeply. And as soon as I had that, I sat down and I wrote what is now, I think, the first paragraph in the book. And that paragraph became, I guess, like a cornerstone for the novel. It was also a touchstone in terms of voice and in terms of who Hannah was. And as soon as I wrote it down, I got the sense that Hannah would be a narrator, that the book would be written in first person, and that here was a girl who had been raised in a very religious family with a father as an elder, a mother who embodied all of the virtues upheld and honoured by this congregation, and yet she herself felt completely different and was essentially struggling to become a woman in the way that women were only allowed to be within that community. And with the voice and the very lyrical nature of it came this sense of a deep musicality that wasn't just about her own perhaps talent for music, although I wanted to write that in, but also as a key for the ways in which she engaged with nature. And I always saw Hannah as being someone who not only is able to access the divine through the church that she belongs to, but also through the natural world, and who sees herself as not separate to it, but as absolutely connected to it. And then Taya really was created, I guess, in reaction to Hannah's sense of herself being different. I knew I wanted to write a love story that would be about total acceptance, total recognition, to the point that it seemed outside of time, that these were two people who absolutely saw one another in all their faults and in all their talents and in all their hopes and aspirations. And I thought by having that kind of, by making the love as pure and as vulnerable and as raw as possible, I could perhaps elevate it out of those narratives that we have received from the past, which inevitably are grounded in shame or repression or betrayal. And so those two characters and their love that they have for one another really rose out of that desire to sort of, you know, place love on a pedestal, I suppose, but also to allow their love and their relationship to also explore other, you know, the other divinities that we might experience within life.
You're listening to The Book Pod, an audio community that brings writers and readers together.
When Taya arrives and she does look quite ghost-like, and you just get this, she's just so clearly in my head, this beautiful sort of ethereal blonde person. And I kept thinking in the first half of the book, what are you intending to do here? How's this love going to play out? Because in the conservative, God-fearing Lutheran community, and then they start traveling across the world to establish this new settlement, I kept thinking, oh, this is not going to end well at all, because of course they won't accept this. Maybe this is a gay relationship that's doomed kind of story. Maybe this is they take flight. And I thought, oh, it would be wonderful if there was an Indigenous tribe who would take them, or another community. Well, of course, there was nobody in South Australia, really. I don't know where I was thinking it was going, but I was willing it to have some sort of happy ending, I suppose, which for me, I was incredibly satisfied in that regard. But midway through, you kill off your narrator. Now, this is the gutsiest thing, you know, in writing that you can actually do. So did that come suddenly, or was that always intended?
It wasn't always intended.
Did you give yourself a fright when you wrote those words?
No, I didn't give myself a fright. It didn't come at the beginning. Well, I had decided that it was going to be a love story between these two characters, and I understood who they would be, they would develop into. And with this book, because the writing of it was so fragmented by having young children and by sleep deprivation, my routine was completely off, and I was sort of just writing where I could in a very non-linear way. And I also allowed myself, I guess, the indulgence of rather than sitting down and plotting out what was going to happen, of just trying things out, of writing material I knew wouldn't make into the book. And I was writing all these scenes, testing out the idea of this love within this community. And I couldn't avoid heartbreak, essentially. I couldn't avoid either the idea of the characters, or one of the characters, not recognizing their feelings for what they are. So sort of caught up in their own ignorance, you know, not without access to a vocabulary to speak to the nature of their love. I couldn't escape the idea that they would be caught eventually, or that in order to leave an oppressive society, they would essentially have to leave and isolate themselves and exist in, you know, who knows? I mean, it wasn't going to work. It would be very difficult to survive. I didn't actually entertain the idea of them, you know, living with the Paramount. And of course, the Paramount people would, you know, dealing with a lot at the same time. It probably would have been a very different novel had that happened. And then I was thinking about the journey over on the boat and the actual journey, which was described in Captain Hahn's journals. And there are many people who died. And one of the reasons they were thought to die initially was because there was a very inept doctor on board who was trying to do things like, he thought nothing of the people. He called them peasants. He called them dogs. He had a very classist attitudes towards these people. And he was using them as guinea pigs, essentially. He wanted to test a live smallpox vaccine on board. He was accused of having ground up broken glass and giving them to children in medicine who later passed away. And I was thinking about the deaths which occurred on the ship, and it occurred to me that maybe one of these characters could die. And then I was thinking, well, one way to elevate that love story, as I was talking about, and one way for my characters to become absolutely clear-eyed about the way that they feel, to recognize it and to potentially act on it, would be to separate them out from using a death from the very narrow parameters that are set in place because of, you know, the historical context. So by killing a character, and then I decided it should be the narrator, I could essentially destroy all the limitations that would otherwise come by keeping her within that society, within life, hedged in by ideological biases and received notions of love and all of that sort of stuff. I could essentially completely dislocate her and then have her write from that perspective of being an outsider, but that very freeing place where she is no longer facing consequence. She's no longer facing the prospect of punishment. She's no longer facing shame. You know, the worst possible thing has happened to her, and she is free, therefore, to remain devoted to the love of her life. And, you know, the rest of what happens in the second half of the book then flowed on very easily from there. And once I decided this, I knew on a very gut level that it was the right thing to do. I was also scared because I knew it would be the equivalent of basically taking my reader for a walk and then pushing them off a cliff. And it would come down to a lot of reader trust. And some readers have written to me and said, no, I couldn't do it. How dare you? You know, they're furious, and I completely appreciate that. But there are lots of people who have stayed with the book and who I think have come to an understanding that it was the only way it could be written. And the other reason why I wanted to do that with Hannah is because it allowed me to separate her from the bias and the probably racism and the colonial mindset of those immigrants, and give her essentially a modern day comprehension of the consequences of colonization. And this was one of the big things in coming to write this book that I was really worried about, because I was never going to write from the perspective of an Indigenous or First Nations character. That's not my voice to appropriate. That's not my culture to appropriate. That's not my space to take up. So I knew that the alternative would be to write from the perspective of a white settler, a white colonizer. And I would have to honor their particular mindset that they had from that time. And I had no desire to do that. I mean, what story could I tell? I mean, who does that serve? It's not something I wanted to do. So once I thought, no, if she's dead, she's suddenly not of that time, you know, she gets pushed out into a state of timelessness and invisibility where she's free to form her own judgments and experience things that would never be available to her had she continued living. And it was one of those things of, this is what has to happen. You know, it was something that I understood on a body level. And then, of course, there were all these other wonderfully exciting creative pathways where I could take that, and I could take her after her death. And that was probably one of the most joyous parts of writing this book, was allowing myself to kind of move off into new territory as a writer.
Your imagination is huge in that back half of the novel. And it's so funny because in the book clubs, there have been discussions along the lines of, well, you know, look, the ghost wouldn't have done that. And we've gone, but how do you know?
This is the thing, right?
Where's the book that says how a ghost feels or responds? Or it was just, it was breathtaking. But again, and I don't want to give anything away, but the last sort of 50 pages, you talk about Hannah being a kind of an outsider. She is absolutely an insider in those last in that last part of the book, and it's some of the most beautiful love writing, and beyond romance, you know, just pure love between couples, love between parents and losing a child, love between Hannah and Taya, love for a new baby. I mean, it's brimful of the joy of love. And that's what I meant before when I ended the book on a bit of a high. Hannah, you said in an interview last year that it took you some time actually to get the courage to write about your home country. And I wondered, before we address how you did this, and you talked briefly about your feeling about going into the First Nations space, but whether you would do us the honour of reading a little bit from your devotion.
Yeah, sure. I might read a section from when this community arrives in South Australia and they've received word that they are allowed to build a village on what is Paramount Country up in the Adelaide, in the Mount Lofty Ranges. And this is the impression that Hannah forms of this country. The sound of this country is one long sustained note that does not end. It is a humming that holds all the other music of this place in harmony. Every other sound is threaded upon it. It was at the port that I began to curate new litanies. Between the bullock drivers that rumbled in from Adelaide, the sailors, the merchants, the English come in search of labourers, I found words given to the music I heard against the constant run of the wind amongst the rushes and sand dunes. She oak for the tree was long-scaled needles whistling the wind in a way that made my skin lift. Magpie lark for the two-shriek calling peep in changing hours. Salt paper bark for the crooked trees groaning wooded cupped fruit. Mangrove, wattle, saltbush. In the months that came afterwards, I learned new words as the congregation did, as they crossed the dusty ticking plains of Adelaide. I placed them next to one another upon the deeper vibration of this country. Galah, cockatoo, lorikeet, kangaroo, wallaby, possum, emu, goanna, quoll. Now, years later, sitting on the lip of this valley, I can make prayer beads of the trees that crown me, the small living things glimpsed if I am still and silent, red gum, blue gum, kwandong, stringy bark, and the birds ever here, ever singing, a liturgy to govern the hours towards gods of cry and shriek and call, kookaburra, magpie, shrike, thrush, wagtail, currawong, crow, bubuk. Scripture may no longer roll off my tongue in smooth certainty, but my mouth is still full of spirit, holy writ of living things, each one a prayer against the teeth. Nature had always been my whetstone, had always made me keener, and after the congregation reached the foothills, I felt myself sharpened to life. The landscape on the ascent to the ranges was unlike anything I had ever seen before. I thought the pine forests back in Kay a place of divinity, but this country was infinitely more sovereign. Each morning, while it was yet dark, the birds filled the air with singing so that the sun, when it rose, brought light to symphony. The birds were everywhere, hosts of raucous angels, black-bodied, yellow-topped messengers of shrieking delight. Soot-streaked coral masters, feather-fat kookaburras suddenly, alarmingly proselytizing to the dawn. Even the trees grew in such a way as to welcome the sun to the world. In Prussia, canopies were dense and thick. Forest floors were deeply shadowed. Here was a place of lightness. Leaves dappled thin and shiny, fluttered pink, grey, green. I crushed them in my palm and smelled medicine, healing. Hot still days dropped branches, all bone crack and brought the sounds of bees. Sometimes I smelled honey warming the air. Animals were muscled fur and liquid eyes or scaly thicknesses, tongues darting. All of it, trees and possums and kangaroos and bright beads of ants circling trunks, veered from stillness to flashing movement in an instant. There was energy here, rough softness. Sometimes it rained, and when it stopped, the air was perfume, a clean scent of wet leaf and damp sweetness. I wanted to drink that washed summer air. I imagined it tasted of reprieve.
That is just beautiful, Hannah. That is absolutely beautiful. Why have you waited so long? Why did you hear? So tell me your thoughts about writing about your homeland.
Yeah, I think you write the books that you're ready to write. And I think that it has perhaps taken this long for me to feel ready to write about something about which I'm deeply familiar. You know, I was raised in the Adelaide Hills. I had a very wonderful nature-filled childhood. But I was anxious for a long time as a writer about writing things that were familiar to me. I never really took the advice to write what you know. For me, writing has always come from what I don't know. And that's true of, you know, countries and new places, but also of history, what isn't in history. These are the things which have always sort of interested me. And so I was a bit anxious coming to write this book once I decided that I was going to write about Australia, because I had used my sense of wonder, which came from my complete lack of familiarity with Iceland and then Ireland, to really find a way to write about those landscapes. With Iceland, You know, it's funny. It's like, this is what travel does, right? When you go to a new place, I mean, if we can remember what travel is, you go to a new place and time slows down. Time has a different pace because you're suddenly assaulted by all this novelty, you know, and you take in the world around you in a way that sometimes I think we can struggle to when we're at home. And I was concerned that I wouldn't be able to find that same sense of wonder that I could then write out of to try and distill all the qualities of a landscape to the page. I knew I loved it. I knew that I loved the Australian landscape deeply, but that only made me more anxious because I wanted to honour it. What I ended up doing was that place of play and those early stages of drafting things down was just try to really lean into that love instead of that lack of familiarity, to try and, you know, I guess focus on the things which also perhaps as a child I loved the most. I think I really lent on that child sense of wonder that I experienced growing up in this place when I felt, you know, that time in my life when I felt very connected to the landscape and felt completely, you know that we were the same entity, you know, as children do. And so a lot of, I guess, my memories of being out in the hills and in the ranges, of the ways in which me and my sister would play in the paddocks and be around the dam and things like that, I think that's what seemed to loom large when I was writing about it. And it was, I guess, the way I found my way back into language as a means of, yeah, that distillation. But, yeah, it wasn't something that I did lightly, because it always, as much as I wanted to write about the landscape, I also knew that I was doing so within a context of colonization, and that was something I really had to get my head around in terms of the sorts of views that I would be representing in this book. And I wanted to make sure that I could essentially, you know, write a modern novel, even though it had a historical timeline. That was sorted by doing what I did to Hannah.
Before Christmas in November, we had Kate Grenville as our guest, our webinar guest, and we talked about A Roommate of Leaves, which is her most excellent novel on the fictional account of Elizabeth MacArthur's journey out to Australia with her husband John, and then, of course, those first few years as part of the Second Fleet settlement. And she writes also beautifully about the Australian bush, as you would know, and her perspective is very much the newcomer coming to this land. What I loved about your Hannah is that she is the newcomer at the beginning, and so are the characters who are part of this new community. But then as the years pass, and just that passage that you read there, Hannah talks about Australia like you, like those of us who have grown up in Australia. It's our breath. It's we've grown up with it. The crackling of the leaves, the smell of gums and eucalypts after rain, all of that stuff is just in our psyche. And then I guess for visitors tonight who have come to Australia from another country, it's probably the wonderment of discovering it. But in the one novel, you've captured both the observations of the newcomer and then the familiarity of somebody who deeply loves the continent. It's very clever.
Oh, that's very kind of you to say. I think one thing that I really did, and this is, you know, part and parcel of the sort of the weird way that I do research, is I looked at a lot of paintings and drawings that had been done of the landscape very shortly after the arrival of the British, and the way that that transformed. And I always remember I had this great art teacher in high school, and he did exactly this. He showed us paintings and he said, look, this is supposed to be the Australian bush. And we're like, why do all the trees look like oak trees and pines? And he says, because they just lacked the ability to sort of to accurately represent that. And then he showed us various slides, but you see slowly that ability to understand the Australian landscape come through. And so you lean on little experiences and memories like that in trying to do it. But that's very kind of you to say so. And
Hannah, we've had a couple of questions, and there have been a couple of questions, and they've both been most eloquently put and respectfully put, the questions about your faith or your spirituality of your own. Can you share your faith story?
Yeah, I was really anxious I guess I gave a lot of thought to the way in which I would represent religion and faith in this book, because I think, you know, for good reason, there's a lot of narratives out there. I mean, there's various, organisations of religious faith who have done incredibly detrimental and go on to do and still do incredibly detrimental things to the LGBTQA plus community. but I was anxious not to make this a story of us and them. And I wanted to rather, I guess the only way in which I wanted to, you know, go out and disagree with the church is by saying, look, I think there are, essentially I wanted to show that I think that there are many ways to God, and that there are many things to, many ways to the divine, and that they're not one is greater or lesser than the others. And I think that is why, you know, the book is titled Devotion, is that there are many things in, that we can, many higher powers that we might surrender to in order to give our lives meaning and fulfillment. And this is probably the closest representation of my own spiritual beliefs. It's worth saying that I did go to church of my own volition. I wasn't raised in a religious family. I started going when I was about 13, and I went for about 3 or 4 years. And I, you know, I had many wonderful experiences within that church and met many people who I felt really embodied the things which I feel lie at the core of Christianity. But it was those, you know, it was a certain amount of black and white thinking and attitudes towards queer people, towards people of other faiths that eventually caused me to leave the church, not in any sort of grand, you know, disavowal, just stopped going. But I'm deeply interested in matters of spirituality in the same way that I'm interested in things that are mysterious, and things like love that we cannot see. We cannot prove the existence of love other than we feel it and we know it to be true. And I think I'm also interested in faith, and not for what it is itself, but for what it says about the faithful and the hopes and the fears and the desires that we have. I think as a novelist, you know, it always comes back to people, what fascinates you about, you know, the human experience and faith, and how people relate to faith says so much about that. In the same way that, you know, the supernatural does. It doesn't actually matter whether or not the ghosts are real or not. It's the people's attitudes towards the ghost. It's always about the person running from the ghost than the ghost itself. I don't know if that really answers those questions in any kind of detail, other than to say I wanted to be respectful of the various faith systems that are portrayed, you know, that are included in the book. But that it was always my intention to show that there are perhaps many roads to spiritual fulfillment.
There was a bit of anguish amongst a couple of the book clubbers over our recent discussion of this book about how Hannah was robbed because she'd been brought up to believe in this, you know, you'll arrive at the pearly gates kind of scenario. And of course, she's floating around the Australian bush in the first instance, picking seaweed and shells out of her ears and her nose and everything. But Pia, one of our gang, asks the most interesting question here, Hannah. She says, when Hannah dies, there is no heaven, God or Jesus awaiting her at all. She had a very fundamentalist Christian upbringing with no exposure to any other belief system. In your view, how did she come to terms with this?
I wanted to show the grieving process that comes when you leave religion, whether it's you're forced out of, you know, a religious congregation or a religion or a faith practice, or whether you do so of your own accord. And I actually read a lot about people who had left closed religious communities, whether they were pushed out or whether they decided to, some of whom were gay. And many of them described that irrespective of their attitudes towards, you know, the institution or the community, there was always a great sense of loss and a need to sort of reform an identity. And I wanted to capture that grief, because it's never that Hannah is there when she's in her living years thinking, I disagree with the church. You know, she has a deep love of God and she has a deep faith in the scripture that is, you know, delivered to her often via her father, who has this very sort of, you know, black and white, very narrow idea of how to, you know, reach heaven. But I was also cautious not to have her necessarily meet other ghosts, for instance, and to sort of make a statement about what I think, you know, the afterlife is like. I mean, I think Hannah's experience of her own afterlife in the years after her death is very specific to her and the way that she relates to the world. And I wanted to make sure that that was the case. In some ways, it's almost that she manufactures her own way of being in the world after she's died. But yeah, I think the grief...
You do introduce people who can feel her and even see her. The baby, for example, someone has mentioned that in one of the questions, the way the baby could see Hannah after, you know, and different animals, some of the indigenous folk. There's and of course Taya's mother, which in itself is a whole interesting, the Wendish woman and all of that sort of thing.
I wanted to, it's funny that we use the word ghost, which I think is actually quite an inadequate word when it comes to how at least I perceive Hannah. I think of her much more as a spirit, and that this is that this isn't final. This spiritual existence for her isn't final at all. It's temporary, and it's very closely linked to her great love and devotion to Taya, and that there is still some resolution that is clearly needed. And, you know, part of that might be her own realization of the true nature of her feelings. It might be simply waiting for Taya, but I always envisage that there is an ongoing, you know, different spiritual existences for the both of them, beyond the you know, what is on the page, beyond the book itself. So ghost, I think, is, you know, we have kind of these preconceived ideas of ghosts and the sort of immateriality, and I never really envisaged, you know, Hannah like that at all. You know, I think she leads, you know, an incredibly physical existence in many ways after she's died, but it's certainly on a different spiritual plane. But, you know, there's a reason why I also included, you know, many characters who sense her or perceive her, because I think there's many people in my own life who, I know there are many people, many of my relations have seen ghosts, sort of runs in the family, and, you know, they don't like to talk about it, but there's all these other sort of experiences that I have no explanation for, but I absolutely, you know, believe that those were the experiences of these people that I love and who I trust. So, you know, it's about exploring the mystery, right? It's not about having definitive answers about any of it. And I love that readers have these different interpretations, because a book is only finished once a reader finishes every book. You know, I can't do that. I only half write a book, and then it's a reader who has to come in and apply their own understanding of the world, or their own sense of curiosity, or their own experiences to.
And that's why we love fiction. So just a couple of quick things. The chapter headings, are they in any shape, way or form, not the actual headings, but the section headings, are they supposed to represent the resurrection, the 3 days, that sort of thing? I mean, that was the most interesting device that you used.
Yeah, I think because quite early in the book, Hannah talks about how this particular community allow 3 days, which is true, it's what they did. And I thought that worked very well then, by the time I was sort of in the latter drafts and I was doing these sort of structural edits, and it seemed to make sense that because that was relevant for Hannah within her lifetime, why not give it relevance? I'm not saying it's definitive and it's the only thing that happens, but for her and her experience, it comes back to sort of play a role. And you could argue that it's coincidence, but you could also argue that it's simply, I don't know, the ongoing ripple of how she understood life when she was living.
And then there was a lot of discussion about the brown snake at the end. Oh, yeah. So was there some sort of, you know, kind of a biblical or a spiritual reason for the snake itself, or was it in fact just a reminder that this is part of the Australian landscape and they're everywhere and we should beware?
I think it's, I wrote it absolutely knowing that there is, you know, a very powerful symbol in this, a biblical symbol in using a snake, and particularly within the context of what happens in that chapter. But it was not necessarily what led me to pick it. I'm related to these communities of Germans on my father's mother's side, on my grandmother's side, and I was thinking about my grandmother's life a lot. She had a very interesting life and put up with a lot, and was in embodied, I guess, the values of these communities in many ways. She, you know, she had to put up bushfires, and she had to protect her children in this very sort of rural landscape. And I always remember her telling me about the snakes. And I was thinking about the ways in which the various dangers that present themselves to people who are in these situations. And I kept coming back to what my grandmother told me about brown snakes, and, you know, the constant presence of them everywhere here. You know, my daughter is terrified of snakes. I have no idea why. We've just sort of, you know, told her to be careful, and if she sees one, to, you know, go still and tell us. But I think it's it looms large, I guess, in the consciousness of people who live in a place like this, where we see them all the time. And, you know, they pose a very real danger. It's probably the greatest danger from the natural landscape or from nature that they would face. So it felt natural. I think anything else possibly would have been too dramatic.
It was a surprise and dramatic ending, but it just beautifully concludes. I'm just in awe of your talent, Hannah. I really am. And I can't wait to see what's on the books next. What is on the books next, by the way?
Well, at the moment, I've been doing sort of some revisions because Run Rabbit Run, this film script is currently shooting, as I said. So I'm still working on that at the moment, although I think that's all wrapped up now. And then I think it's probably travel related, and depending on what we're able to do and where we're about to go. It's never for me a matter of trying to find an idea. I have about 4 ideas for various books and projects on various back burners in my mind. But I'm interested in returning overseas as a setting. And, you know, my concerns, I think, will always sort of remain similar. I think I'd really love to explore the various attitudes we have towards nature. I mean, I think it's a sign of the times too, that I'm preoccupied with nature and the natural world and the things that are happening with our climate. And I'm not saying I'm going to write a climate crisis novel, but I think it just is becoming an ever bigger part of my approach to writing and the kind of stories I want to tell. But yeah, I'd love to return overseas, but we shall see what I'm able to do and what research I'm able to access. So,
well, I remember when you visited the shop in 2016, you and I talked about your upbringing and your childhood and your child's imagination, and you were outdoors a lot. I remember you telling me a lot about that. So I think you've always had an affinity with nature. But you're absolutely right. It's the topic really at the moment. And if we can keep bringing it into fiction and nonfiction, it increases and enhances our love and our understanding. Just one last question, Hannah. It's nearly 10 years, of course, since Burial Rites. And I wonder, now that you look back on the extraordinary international success of that book, particularly given it was your debut novel, it was your first foray into the book publishing world, translated into more than 30 languages, won so many awards in Australia, the list goes on of its achievements. When you look back at Burial Rites, what are your thoughts, just briefly?
Oh, I just have an overwhelming sense of gratitude. I mean, that book, you know, I wrote that book with very little, you know, anticipation or expectation of publication, let alone the reception it received. But I'm hugely grateful to it because it allowed me to continue writing. It gave me my writing career. And, you know, I'm still pinching myself, to be honest. I know it's been 10 years, but I still can't believe that it happened. And I still have the absolute privilege of hearing from readers who are reading Burial Rites for the first time. So it doesn't become old. And I still, I think, remain just as obsessed with that case and with Agnes Magnus Dottir as I ever was. The book was so special to me for so many reasons beyond the manner in which it was received and published. So yeah, it will always be a huge, huge part of my life.
The film is still going ahead?
Yeah, at this stage, yes. COVID, you know, really threw a lot of spanners in the film industry. But yeah, at this stage, it's still happening. So, you know, as soon as I know something, I'll be sure to be seeing it from the rooftop. So fingers crossed, because I know, you know, it's a difficult time. But yeah, that's all still happening.
Well, we would love to see Agnes portrayed on the big screen. She's a beautiful character. It's a wonderful story, as are all your 3 stories, Hannah, and all the many other ones that are in your head and in your notebooks and not quite finished and that to be a novel. I wish you every success for a terrific career. There's a generation of Australians now who are completely glued onto you, and everything that you write, we have the pleasure of reading. So thank you.
That's very kind, Corrie. Thank you so much, and thank you for having me tonight. It's a real privilege to be able to speak about devotion.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.